The remainder of this OQ looks at diabetes. First, reviewing the latest thinking regarding the causes and impact of the increasing prevalence of the condition, and then discussing new advances in its detection and management. Diabetes is a common, lifelong health condition. Approximately 3.2 million people in the UK have been diagnosed with diabetes, 240,000 of whom were diagnosed in the past year, and an estimated further 630,000 have the condition but are undiagnosed. The figures are predicted to rise to 5 million diagnosed cases by 2025, placing increasing pressure on our general and ocular health systems. The NHS spends £10 billion a year, 10% of its entire budget, dealing with diabetes and its complications. A common complication is damage to the eyes. Most people with diabetes will develop some form of retinopathy caused by high levels of glucose in the blood. In our first interview on this topic, Simon O'Neill, Director of Health Intelligence at the national charity Diabetes UK, begins with an outline of the current situation in the UK.
Diabetes is one of the biggest health threats in the UK at the moment, and we're seeing an enormous rise in the numbers of people living with diabetes. Currently, there are about 3.2 million people who have diagnosed diabetes in the UK, and we estimate there's another 633,000-ish who probably have type 2 diabetes already but don't yet know it. And even more worrying is that those numbers are just set to rise and rise. We expect there to be 5 million people, as you said, by 2025. Why is that happening? Well, let's first of all see if we can understand what the differences are between the two types of diabetes, which are most common. There are two types. Type 1 is the rarer type of diabetes, really, and it tends to affect largely younger people, especially in adolescence or in their early 20s. And type 1 diabetes is an autoimmune disease. In other words, the body attacks itself for some reason, and we don't understand exactly why that happens. Type 1 diabetes tends to come on very quickly with very dramatic symptoms, and the only treatment for it is insulin injections. And about 10% of all the people in the UK with diabetes, and in fact worldwide with diabetes, have type 1. Type 2 diabetes, on the other hand, is very much a lifestyle-related condition. It's very strongly linked in families, so we know there's a big genetic compound to it, but we know that about 90% of people with type 2 diabetes are overweight or obese, so lifestyle factors play a huge part. And that's the type that we're really seeing increasing year on year. And about 90% of people in the UK, and again worldwide, who have diabetes, have type 2. Why do we think it's rising so much? Well, we're seeing 240,000 new cases of diabetes every year. And that means that the numbers of actually diagnosed diabetes are increasing by about 150,000 cases each year as people die with diabetes as well. Why we're seeing the increasing prevalence is because we're probably also seeing a similar prevalence in the numbers of people with obesity and those who are overweight. And that trend has been going on for some time. And if we look at the US, where that trend has been going on for longer, they have an even higher percentage rate of people with diabetes. We're currently talking about 6% of the population in the UK, but that's rising steadily year on year. The lifestyle elements of that are huge, therefore, and interventions we know can make a really big impact. If you look at people who are at very high risk of type 2 diabetes, we know that 80% of those cases could be prevented if they took earlier action to lose weight and become more physically active. So it's a hugely preventable condition, but unfortunately, that isn't happening, and we're seeing the numbers increase year on year. And that's why Diabetes UK makes such an effort in risk assessment, telling people when they're at risk of developing type 2 diabetes and enabling them to understand what action they have to take to actually stop type 2 diabetes happening to them. A recent study came out looking at the population of the UK, and they estimated that one in three people had what they called pre-diabetes. We would slightly disagree with those figures because what they use is an American cutoff point, which isn't actually agreed by anybody else in the world. We take a cutoff point of high risk of diabetes that's slightly higher. But even using that higher risk factor, we think that one in four adults, that's 11.5 million people, are probably at very high risk of developing type 2 diabetes in the UK. And that's a very worrying statistic when we know that it's preventable, we know it's reversible, But we can't really see any change happening. Those numbers rise year on year. Pre-diabetes is one of those unhelpful terms, we feel. When we talk to people who have been given a diagnosis of pre-diabetes, they often believe that therefore diabetes is inevitable, that they will go on to develop type 2 diabetes no matter what they do. And therefore it can actually be a bit of a negative label. We prefer to use the term high risk of diabetes because that encourages people to think that they can do something to lower their risk and they can walk away from type 2 diabetes. Moving on to really the role of the optometrist, optometrists see a lot of people with diabetes each year and a lot of people at high risk of diabetes, and Diabetes UK would believe that optometry has a role to play in really supporting people with diabetes but also raising awareness about the risk factors for it. One of the issues that is raised is knowledge of HbA1c. Now HbA1c is a bit of a long technical term, basically means glycated haemoglobin. As glucose goes around in the bloodstream, it attaches itself to the haemoglobin, and we can measure how much glucose is attached to haemoglobin. And as haemoglobin only lasts for about 3 months in the body, we can get a good idea of how well the blood glucose has been controlled over the 3 months before the test is done. And therefore HbA1c is now used as a diagnostic tool for type 2 diabetes, because many people with type 2 diabetes will have actually had diabetes for several years before they're actually picked up. But also it's a way of telling when people are, or how well people are controlling their diabetes once we know they have it. Therefore, it could be something which optometrists, if you're aware of somebody's HbA1c, it can give you a good indication of how well they're looking after their diabetes and how high their risk is of then developing complications, including complications of the eye. And therefore, it's probably worth having that conversation with the patients you know who have type 2 diabetes to see how well they are controlled. In optometry as well, there's various new developments coming on stream which are quite interesting, and whether they will lead to anything you can never really tell. But one of those is autofluorescence testing. And there's been some studies over the years looking at skin autofluorescence and how well that indicates somebody's level of control if they have diabetes. But recently, some studies have come out, particularly looking at autofluorescence of the lens of the eye and whether you can actually use that to detect people who have undiagnosed type 2 diabetes. And the studies, though they're fairly small, seem to suggest that it is a tool which could actually tell if people have undiagnosed type 1 or type 2 diabetes. From the point of view of Diabetes UK, we feel that's a little bit late, because once they've already got type 2 diabetes, there's not a lot you can do to reverse it. And you then have to manage it. And we would rather people were screened for their risk so that we can prevent them developing type 2 diabetes in the first place. Obviously, autofluorescence as a diagnostic tool is a very new idea and a new concept. And what we don't yet know is exactly what level of autofluorescence will really correspond with what level of diabetes or blood glucose you have. It's not as sort of straightforward as one level would be a definitive yes or no. It'll be more of an indicator of your risk, and obviously you can only really then define that risk in any diagnostic sense by going to the GP or the doctor and having a blood test to confirm exactly where you are on that scale between not having diabetes and having diabetes. But optometrists should really be very aware of the risk factors of type 2 diabetes, so family history, the older you are particularly, high-risk groups such as people from black and Asian minority ethnic backgrounds and those from lower socioeconomic status, but also especially people who are overweight or obese or taking very little exercise, because for those people early changes in the back of the eye or things like autofluorescence of the lens may indicate that somebody already does have type 2 diabetes who may be totally unaware of that fact. And therefore, the optometrist may well be the healthcare professional who can direct them to their GP to get themselves tested and diagnosed if that is what they have. Another thing optometrists may have heard about is the use of special contact lenses to measure glucose levels in the eye as a way of monitoring diabetes. At the moment, we think that's a little bit pie in the sky. It's interesting technology, and obviously scientists are working to see whether they can make it work. But you'll hear more about the potential pitfalls of that later on in this programme. Obviously, optometrists will be aware that across all four nations of the UK, there are retinal screening programmes in place. diabetic retinopathy is obviously one of the most serious complications of diabetes, and it's the leading preventable cause of blindness in the working age population in the UK. And therefore, retinal screening is incredibly important that it's carried out regularly on everybody at risk who has diabetes. There's been lots of discussion about the role of optometry within that, and though Diabetes UK supports the national approach because that way we can ensure good call and recall, good quality assurance programs, ensuring that people do have the right test done with the right equipment, we do feel there is a role for optometrists in between those appointments, both to monitor and maintain the overall health of the eye. People with diabetes are still more likely to develop cataract and glaucoma, but also to ensure that the patients know that they have to go and have that separate test. We often talk to people with diabetes and ask them about their eye test, and they'll say, yes, I had that done and I don't need new glasses. And it's quite obvious that they haven't actually attended their retinal screen, they've just been to see the high street optician. And both things are equally important. And I think optometrists have a role in really trying to get patients to understand that, because they do find it quite complicated as to what the two things are. The good thing about eye health in the UK is that people with diabetes are allowed to have free eye tests, and I think we need to encourage all patients therefore to take that up and not be scared about going to the optometrist on a regular basis. One of the worries is that we know optometry services, especially hospital ophthalmology services, are already very stretched, and what we're seeing is this increasing number of people being diagnosed with type 2 diabetes who will need to have eye screening. And we need to ensure that the current system can actually cope with them. And the National Screening Committee is looking across all four nations at how they can better manage that to try and ensure that people who most need screening get it when they need it, and then also get referred on promptly to the most effective treatment. Because that's the whole point of retinal screening, is not just to see whether somebody has a problem, but to ensure that they then can go on and get treatment to try and prevent blindness. I think optometrists, like pharmacists, are a very underutilised healthcare professional resource. People with diabetes tend to see their diabetes as being managed either in specialist care with diabetic specialist nurses and consultants, or largely now in primary care with their GP and practice nurse. But obviously, pharmacists, optometrists and other healthcare professionals are also seeing patients with diabetes on a regular basis. And when you have somebody in a chair for 20 minutes doing an eye exam, having the opportunity to talk with them, I think there is a real role for optometrists to actually talk about diabetes with their patients and to encourage them to think about how they manage it, to encourage them to take up services that are being offered, such as retinal screening, to make sure they are getting regular reviews done. Diabetes UK produced something called the 15 Healthcare Essentials, and it's a list of the things that everybody with diabetes should have access to over the course of a year. And some of that is biomedical markers, so having blood tests for cholesterol, etc. But some of it is also about how systems are delivered. And I think it would be good if optometrists were aware of those 15 things, just to check with their patients whether they are accessing them. We often know that patients aren't aware of what care they should receive, and if you don't know what care you should be getting, then you're very likely not to get it. And optometrists are in a very good position on an annual basis just to remind their patients with diabetes that these things need to be done each year, as well as checking their eyes and making sure their eye health is good. So in our opinion, we could really use the resources of optometry and the high street opticians to support people with diabetes to live well and to get the care they need.
Thank you, Simon. Diabetic retinopathy is the most common cause of preventable sight loss in the working age population. With diabetes diagnoses increasing, the number of patients who present with some form of diabetic retinopathy will correlate. Mr. Robin Hamilton, a consultant ophthalmic surgeon, specializes in diabetic retinopathy. And in this interview with Philip Morgan, he continues the discussion to cover the risk factors for developing retinopathy and how the existing care system operates.
Hi, Robin. What are the risk factors other than diabetes for developing diabetic retinopathy?
Well, I think when you first consider a patient with diabetes, it's important to consider the duration of the diabetes and in particular the control of the diabetes. Other factors, such as blood pressure, are significant in the progression of diabetes, and in particular what treatment you're on for the blood pressure. Other factors also include lipid control, triglyceride and cholesterol control, renal function, smoking, and in particular pregnancy.
With regards to the control of blood pressure, are some medications more prone to promoting development of diabetic retinopathy?
I think rather than promoting diabetic retinopathy, there are some studies that show there are particular antihypertensive which are beneficial for the progression of diabetic retinopathy, in particular ACE inhibitors, and that was shown in the Euclid study.
So the diabetics should have their blood pressure controlled by ACE inhibitors as a matter of preference, as long as good control can be achieved with that medication?
Yes. I think primarily getting the blood pressure under control is a good thing. ACE inhibitors in trials do show an extra benefit over other antihypertensives, so should be included in the antihypertensive treatment that the patient receives.
Can you outline the current guidelines for the treatment and management of ocular effects of diabetes?
When you're considering the treatment of diabetic retinopathy or diabetic maculopathy, you have to look, as mentioned already, at their diabetic control, blood pressure control, etc. So it shouldn't be seen as just treatment of the eyes when the patient is seen in a hospital eye service. In particular, though, when we're talking about treatment of diabetic retinopathy, we should break down the treatment into two groups, and that's treatment for proliferative retinopathy or severe non-proliferative diabetic retinopathy, and also diabetic macular edema. The mainstay for treatment for the proliferative retinopathy still is laser therapy, and the laser therapy is performed within the hospital eye service currently, and there is no plans to change that for the future. There are trials ongoing, however, into anti-VEGF for treatment of proliferative retinopathy, and these will be reported in the near future, I would expect. End-stage proliferative retinopathy is often treated not only with the laser but with also with surgery, particularly in the cases of traction retinal detachment or vitreous hemorrhage. The second part of the diabetic retinopathy is really the diabetic maculopathy and diabetic macular edema. And again, these should be broken down into clinically significant macular edema and centre involving diabetic macular edema. Clinically significant macular edema, still the mainstay of treatment is laser therapy. And again, that is performed in the hospital eye service. The other part of diabetic macular edema is center-involving diabetic macular edema. And traditionally we used to use laser therapy for this, but now we are using anti-VEGF and steroid injectables. Of the anti-VEGF, Lucentis is licensed and NICE approved. Eylea is licensed but yet to be NICE approved. Avastin is unlicensed and also unapproved by NICE. And these injections, initially you have a loading dose of the injections, but they are very useful for center-involving diabetic macular edema. And for the first time, rather than stabilizing vision, we are now actually getting improvement in vision, and we're looking at improvement in 30 to 50% of patients, either gaining either 15 or 10 letters. So this is a bit of a sea change for our diabetic patients and a real advantage, because these patients are not getting any side effects from the macular laser and only benefits from these injections.
Triamcinolone is a steroid-based
yes.
drug, I believe.
Yeah.
Are there concerns about raised intraocular pressure when using that injectable?
There are concerns using all three of the steroids that we use injectables now. So as you mentioned, there's triamcinolone. And the triamcinolone comes in a number of different formulations. At the moment in the UK, we primarily use Kenalog. There also is Trivaris and Triesence, which do not contain any preservatives. The other two, as I mentioned earlier, Ozurdex and Iluvien, are also steroids, and there are concerns about intraocular pressure rises in all three groups. The main concern really is with triamcinolone. In the past, Iluvien used to give a significant concern for physicians when it's in its previous guise of Posodex. But as in its current formulation, Iluvien only gives limited risk for raised intraocular pressure. Saying that, all clinicians should be aware and monitoring should be fairly close for all three drug types.
So do you think that's a role that optometrists could have in terms of continuing care for their diabetic patients? Should they be advised by the hospital, if they're having that treatment, to attend optometry clinics on a regular basis to have them pressures monitored?
Absolutely. In something, for example, like with Iluvien, which potentially lasts 3 years, monitoring these patients for raised intraocular pressure could well be done in a shared care manner between the hospital eye service and the optometry practices.
What sort of time interval would that monitoring take place over? Would it be every 6 months or year or more frequently than that?
I think that would depend on the patient, to be honest with you. Initially, we tend to see our patients at a month, which is when the first concerns about intraocular pressure rises occur. And then subsequent to that, depending on the patient, it certainly could be seen as part of a shared care, but each case is different.
Okay, thank you. Most optometrists are aware of the laser photocoagulation and for proliferative retinopathy and maculopathy, but have there been any advances in the treatment or new techniques since this was introduced, other than the injectables that we were previously talking about, the CMO?
Laser therapy has been the mainstay for treatment for a number of years. More recently in the treatment, not only for proliferative retinopathy, but maculopathy, we have been using pattern lasers. So there are a number of lasers out there which do this, and they tend to use slightly shorter duration than those lasers that we used to use in the past, particularly those recommended in the ETDRS study. For diabetic macular edema, we have also progressed with our lasers and are now using much shorter pulse duration, such as MicroPulse, the selective retinal therapy, and now the 2RT nanopulse lasers.
What are your views on the increase in the numbers of new cases and how the current system will cope under the increased stress?
I think that's a very good question, and I think the first thing to do is look at the reality and look at the numbers. It's really going to be a doubling potentially over every 10 to 15 years, and that's going to have a significant knock-on effect in the eye services. I think, however, the diabetic control is actually a lot better than it used to be in the past, so the incidence and prevalence of diabetic retinopathy is probably going to be less. Fortunately, diabetics are living longer these days, and so again, a knock-on effect of that will be that there'll be more patients within our clinics that need treatment. At the moment, our patients still need a lot of laser and a lot of injections, but we do find from the studies that out towards year 4 and 5, the number of injections that these patients actually need is minimal. So 1, potentially 2 injections per year, which is actually fairly small numbers. I think shared care is going to be the way forward with these patients. More clinics in the community, more optometry involvement, and in Moorfields we have a lot of optometrists involved, not only in our clinics, but in our injection services too.
Do you know of any schemes which utilise primary and secondary care links in managing diabetic retinopathies to greater success than the standard referral scheme?
There are really two ways for patients to get into the hospital eye services with diabetic retinopathy. Either they come as a direct referral from the GP or optometrist, or they come through the diabetic eye screening program. The diabetic eye screening program is very good at filtering all the diabetics and getting the patients with the real pathology into the clinics. We do, however, see a number of instances where you get a lot of patients who have minimal pathology, who do need only minimal clinical input. And the diabetic screening programs and the hospital eye services are trying to link, again with some optometry practices, via the OPDR pathway to try and see these patients in the community rather than in the hospital eye service. Now, in some places that is working very nicely, in some places it's not, and that really depends on local CCGs, clinical commissioning groups, and local service provision. For example, in Moorfields, where I have previously been a clinical lead in Ealing, we have a good scheme working with some of the optometrists over there doing an OPDR pathway outside in the community, but it's in its infancy at the moment and we expect it to improve.
OPDR? I'm not familiar with that term.
It's a term that we use for outpatient diabetic retinopathy, and there are two groups that we put into that. There are patients who have maculopathy but are unlikely to need any treatment. So those are M1, so as in maculopathy positive, that don't need any treatment. And there are those patients who have retinopathy which is not mild, but is heading towards the moderate level, but again is unlikely to need any treatment, but needs more frequent follow-up rather than yearly follow-up in a screening service.
If an optometrist were to encounter a patient presenting with the risk factors for retinopathy, would it be appropriate for them to provide input? And if so, how?
In a patient who has long-standing diabetes, I think it is certainly a good place for an optometrist to give advice about general health, general diabetic control. And it's certainly a place where you can discuss with them how often are they being seen by their diabetologist, how often are they being seen by their GP, do they know what their HbA1c level is, do they know how their diabetes is controlled, do they know their blood pressure. So this is all fairly basic advice, and simple questions can help to educate the patients. From an ophthalmic point of view, in the hospital eye service, one thing that we have not done well is link in with the GPs and link in with the local hospital. And what we're developing in Moorfields is a patient passport, a little bit like the passport that you have at the moment with your warfarin and your INR. So it's something the patient carries around with them all the time. And you can fill it in, so a diabetologist can fill it in. The patient can fill it in with their sugar control. The ophthalmologist can fill it in with their retinopathy status, their maculopathy status, or blood tests they're doing as and when necessary. So that when the patient then goes back to the diabetologist or the GP, if they have retinopathy, then the GP knows, hold on a minute, I need to control this a little bit better than I have done in the past. And I think that's really valuable for the patients, and I don't think that is done enough. And the patient won't be able to give the details back to the GP unless there is a letter, and a regular letter. We tend to do letters all the time, but it's getting the information to everybody, and it's actually getting the patient involved in the information. Patients who walk around with their INR booklet know exactly what their INR is. They know exactly what tablets they're taking. They don't miss their tablets. You can do that with a diabetic patient. They don't miss their tablets. They control their diabetes. They're thinking about it on a daily basis. You get better control, less need for treatment, less co-pathologies.
Thank you, Robin and Philip.